For many of us, seeing the beauty in other people, being kind and compassionate towards other people, that comes pretty easily. But what's really hard is seeing the beauty in ourselves and being kind and compassionate consistently towards ourselves, especially when difficult things happen. Perhaps someone's critical of us, or we make a mistake. We beat up on ourselves. You could call it the inner critic, or that voice in the head that says mean things. Or you could call it self-hatred. What can we do in these circumstances to interrupt this cycle and learn to befriend ourselves consistently? Sounds True has created the Self-Acceptance Project to investigate this question. We've invited the participation of spiritual teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, visionary writers, all to look at how can we learn to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves on a consistent basis. Thank you for joining us and welcome. In today's episode, I speak with Harville Hendrix. Harville holds a PhD in psychology and theology from the University of Chicago and is the best-selling author of Getting the Love You Want and Keeping the Love You Have. With Sounds True, he has released the audio works Finding and Keeping Love and Marriage as a Path to Wholeness. Welcome, Harville.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Tammy.
Now, I know you've introduced a concept into the world of relationships, and when I first heard it, I was dumbfounded and disbelieving, and it's the idea of zero negativity in relationships. And my question for you is, do you think it's possible to apply this concept of zero negativity to how one relates to oneself?
Yes. The short answer is yes. And the longer answer to that is that, to start at a big concept, the concept of zero negativity is implicit in and explicit in most of practices of most of the spiritual traditions of the world. The very fact of sitting in meditation and watching your thoughts arising and learning to release them without judgment, to let them go, that's a part of moving toward what we would call a relational zero negativity. This would be relationship to the self zero negativity. So yes, it's possible to do that. So that's the short answer.
Well, let's unpack it a little bit, because I think for most people, I think, experience quite a number of moments of self-criticism, real harshness towards ourselves. So how can we even move in this direction, in your view?
Well, the primary way to move in the direction, I think, from a cognitive perspective, is some thinking and processing about what is the function of negativity. Everything that we do serves some function for our psychic economy. That is, it prevents something from happening or it causes something to happen. There's some sort of causality, I think, in whatever we do. So when, like right now, I know a person who's working on their doctoral dissertation. The dissertation has been ready probably to be turned in for about 3 months or even longer, and everybody is providing an enormous amount of positive appreciation for the dissertation. But this graduate student keeps saying it's not good enough, it's not good enough, it's not good enough. So in questioning what's the function of the it's not good enough, and it's obviously, and they came to it very quickly, that the function of the self-put-down is that if they keep it and tell themselves that it's not good enough and they're not good enough and not smart enough, it prevents them from experiencing a relational transaction with their professor in which what their fears are might in fact come true, so that the function of the negativity is to prevent something from happening that is in their anticipation and anticipatory imagination worse than not turning in the doctoral dissertation. So then the question after that is, well, where does such a process come from? Where does the self-put-down come from? And usually people can trace that back to something that is early in their lives, sometimes all the way back to childhood, when they were engaging in this particular syndrome of self-put-downs and refusal to turn in your doctoral dissertation because of the fearful possibility of a negative judgment. There's a long history of that in which that started off with some experience earlier on. There's always a little bit of a trauma, either a little bit of a trauma or a lot of trauma behind any sort of self-belief that comes up. And then that is interesting. That self-belief then, as I said, serves the psychic economy by preventing something from happening, which if it happened, would be worse than not having the dissertation turned in, and that is the anticipatory rejection would come true.
So what is your recommendation for people when they find themselves in situations like this, where they feel beset with self-judgment or criticism of some kind?
Well, I think there are two things that come to mind about that, and one of them is an exploratory response toward the self as to where does this come from, how old is it, and what is it related to, and to get some ideas, I just said, about what it's protecting you from, that if you don't act, if you don't do. The second thing is to accept, you have to move from the limbic system into the cortical system and start processing the data about that is coming in, the positive data. And I have a personal story about that for myself. I remember I was in my 40s, which is now a long time ago, and was in Dallas, and was at the early stages of developing Imago theory, and I was beginning to lecture publicly about it, primarily then only in Dallas. And I was aware that every time I went to a public, I was on my way to a public place, that the pit of my arms would be so wet on my coat, I then wore a coat and tie all the time, that it was just, you know, soggy wet. And I began to work on what am I imagining is going to happen when I walk on that stage and pick up that microphone at that venue that I'm going to. And it took a while to get that, but my fantasy was that somebody in the audience would be smarter than me, would see me as saying stuff that I couldn't defend or that didn't have any research behind it, and I would be publicly humiliated and shamed. So I got that clear. I mean, I had to do that for a while to get clear of what was going on. So at that particular point, I changed the picture. I changed the outcome picture. And saw people applauding me at the beginning and giving me a standing ovation at the end. And I remember that I held that image in my mind for the 35 minutes that I was in the car. I maintained it. I'm not even sure how I did it, except that I said, this is the outcome I want. This is what I'm going to see. And I also noticed that I'd stopped perspiring. I gave the lecture. I did get a standing ovation. So I began to accumulate that data, is that I am making myself terrified because, and I said to myself one day, I know I'm an expert on my topic. I know more about this topic that I'm talking about than anybody in the world because I made up the theory. I'm the one who invented this. So you might say there are other theories, but you can't, you know, cross me up on this theory and say it's wrong. You may say it's wrong, but you can't say that it's illogical, irrational, because I know what this is. So that was in my 40s, and I still am aware that there was a part of me that didn't think I was smart, although I was not that that anxious about it anymore. Then Getting came out, and I still was sort of shocked that Getting got so much visibility through the Oprah show, but I was still, you know, wondering how it was going to fall. And then people from all over the world started showing up at my training program, 60, 100 at a time, and year after year, two or three groups a year. And one day I was aware of the collapse of a mental construct, which was that I'm not smart, because it was really clear that if I were not smart, these people would not be in my room. So that was a processing of data. So those are the things. Where does it come from? What's the catastrophic imagination in terms of outcome? And then what is the real data? And so it's essentially using the thinking process, the cortical brain, to begin to regulate the limbic brain and begin to assimilate the data that is contrary to the actual situation. I think it doesn't really help. One of the things I tried for a long time was giving myself positive affirmations, because that was supposed to help, and it's in the culture that, you know, the power of positive thinking. I never found that to help. I found that the data helped for me, not some mental construct that I gave myself.
Can you help me understand, Harville, the difference between imagining the audience clapping and going through that visualization and what somebody might call positive thinking or using positive affirmations?
Well, the imagination itself is not what regulated my anxiety. It was the experience of the congruence between the fantasy that I had and the reality. I think if I could not have sustained my sense of intelligence and power. I know I could not have sustained it just with the image. I actually needed some reality confirmation.
Okay, and also just to help me understand, when you say shifting from the limbic to the cortical system of the brain, can you help me understand that?
Well, the limbic brain is where the amygdala is housed, and the amygdala is a part of the brain that is constantly looking for the bad stuff that's going to happen, or whether or not some bad stuff is going to happen. And when there is some sense that something bad could happen or is happening, the limbic brain, there's a neurochemical response as a result of the signal from the coming from the limbic system that something is actually dangerous in the environment. And the neurochemistry of that is cortisol. And when cortisol enters the bloodstream, it's triggered by a fear response. Cortisol then begins to permeate your sensory system, and you begin to feel like you're in a dangerous environment. And it takes some of us a long time to metabolize that so that we're back into something other than that. And usually you can metabolize that only if nothing bad does happen and or if something positive does happen. And then you move to endorphins. But the limbic brain is where the feelings are and is where the neural mechanisms are to sense what kind of safety or danger is there in our environment.
I'd love to know, Harville, because I know this is something you've worked on so much in your work with couples in relationship, what you see as the connection between our ability to be kind and loving towards ourselves and the quality of our intimate relationships.
Well, to me, over the years, I've come to believe there's pretty much a one-to-one correlation. And the reason for that is that it's become clear in my thinking about what reality is that reality is relationship. Reality is connection. And so we are therefore a part of a network, and not all of which we may be, you know, directly or visually or sensorily connected to, but we're part of a network. And that network is our context, and that we are creatures who are, from the 1970s on, with the developmental theories of the social psychologist about the child being a social child, but become pretty clear that we're social beings connected to a social network. That network is what creates our brains. It creates the coherence of our brains. It is the source of our interior life, that our interior life is not self-generated, but generated in relationship and is a function of those relationships. So that if we do not have some sense of safety in our interpersonal relationships, it's very difficult to have internal safety. And I think that we have been often told that we can, in fact, not be influenced and not let people influence us. And I doubt that that's the case. I think that what we're saying is what is one of the cornerstones of some pathologies, which is disassociation, and that there are times when, because we are so anxious and so impacted, we can disassociate and therefore not feel our context. But that's a defense against feeling the context, which if we'd allow ourselves to feel, we'd have another emotion. So I think there's a one-to-one correlation between the quality of the interpersonal and the quality of the intrapsychic.
So let's take someone for an example who's been single for a long time and doesn't want to be single, wants a partner, and would admit to you, you know, I have a lot of self-judgment. I'm not sure that I can really love someone in the way that I feel this potential in my heart, but I don't know if I can do it, and I don't know if I can receive their love either. So there's a lot of self-judgment all tied up. How would you work with such a person?
Well, I would go back to where I started, which is helping them begin to look at those thoughts in terms of their origins, for what, on the one hand, how old are they? And usually if they're pretty chronic, they're pretty old. The second thing that people don't often do after they do the excavation is what's the function of those thoughts. So how is this, what is this protecting you from, that you will have these thoughts that protect you from that? And then what kind of experiments are you willing to do? The behaviorists were very good at talking about operant conditioning and I've forgotten now the word, but sequential something. Anywhere you do a little bit and get some feedback and process the feedback and do a little bit more. So it's sort of a sequential serial experimentation of engagement. I have a son right now who talks about the fact that he has a lot of social anxiety. He's actually going to a therapist, but he's talking to me a lot about it too. And that is that he puts himself in environments that he's afraid of, but only a little bit of a time. And when he feels anxious, he backs out, processes what it is, goes back in, goes a little further. And he's putting himself in different kinds of social situations, processing that. So what he's doing is getting some reality data that would help them understand that the possibilities that they imagine as catastrophic might in fact not be that catastrophic. This is pretty much cognitive therapy behavior, but you have to experiment. You have to put yourself in the context to do that. And then the other thing I've discovered when people get into relational conversations about what they would like but what they fear is I've discovered a term that we've been using a lot in the past 5 years with couples who are kind of not sure they want to stay in the relationship, and that's the power of ambivalence. That if you're ambivalent, it seems that what I can pick up is that when you're ambivalent, your brain doesn't know what to do. So the brain goes into a sort of free flow and a cycle, and when it's not engaged in some intentional project, either being creative or protective, the brain becomes anxious. So that ambivalence feeds on itself. So like if you said, I'm not sure I want to be in this marriage, or people who are in cohabiting relationships who are ambivalent about getting married, but they're in there to experiment with how to be married, when they decide that they are going to go ahead and commit and get married and so forth, what happens when they move from ambivalence to commitment is a great deal of anxiety occurs. The brain now knows it has to do something. It has to go to work. But sitting in the ambivalence for 1 to 3 to 5 years, not much actual growth occurs. So the concept of ambivalence about whatever it is you want to do tends to interfere with any sort of progress toward any sort of goal you might have. So what we help individuals do and couples do is that if you really want to grow, if you really want to move towards some sort of decision to get an outcome, is you have to become intentional. And that is, make a decision, put yourself on the train, get on the train, engage in the train, and then your brain begins then to operate. And then you begin to collect data, you can sort the data and so forth. So I would ask people to to look at the ambivalence, because I think the ambivalence actually, again, protects them from some fearful imagined outcome. Mm-hmm.
Now, Harville, I know you've written a book called Receiving Love, with the emphasis on letting love in. And as part of this conversation, I'd love to hear you talk some about that in light of this question of self-acceptance. And what I'm getting at is, I know people who are in relationships and their partner could perhaps be quite loving, quite adoring of them, but somehow, because of some challenge within themselves, they don't quite let the love in. Can you talk about that and how we can become open to, quote unquote, receiving love?
Well, yes. That book came out of a clinical situation with a couple where a woman, in this case, was complaining about, for her, a very important issue for her husband. It was trivial. And for many people, it might have looked like, well, you know, what's the big deal? And that is that she wanted her husband to thank her for cooking dinner. And he was opposed to that because he went to work every day to make the money to buy the house and, you know, the food for the dinner. And he wasn't asking for thanks for all he was doing. So why she should, you know, she should just do what she is supposed to do, he said. Now, that's what we do. That's your role. This is my role. So, but this was really important to her. And so we did a brief excavation about back to her childhood. And she got really clear to him and to me that when she was a child, she was basically invisible to her mother, and that whatever she did was not okay with her mother, and that she could never please her mother. This was very damaging, left her in a disempowered mode. She didn't know how to get anything done. So we talked about that for a while, and then pushed her a little further as to what would happen if she actually let herself feel good about what she was doing. And she got into a fantasy that her mother, the fantasy was that her mother would really reject her. So he really understood this, and he became really empathic. And he said, you know, I didn't know that that was going to be so important and is so important to you. And given that, I care about you, love you, and I want to say right now how much I thank you for cooking our meals. And I know this is important. I'm going to thank you after every dinner. I'm going to, you know, spend 30 seconds to a minute just telling you how wonderful it was and how much I appreciate you. And she got angry, and she said, you're just doing that because we're in therapy and because in this process, Harville has, you know, encouraged you to see how much it means to me. So you don't really mean it. So that shocked me because she had done this work and he had done his work. So I then asked her to go deeper. And then is where she got into a fantasy, that a memory that if, which was a catastrophic outcome expectation, that if she accepted love, her mother would reject her, because her mother had said to her, you will never be loved, you're not worth being loved, and anytime a man tells you that he loves you in the future, you know, don't believe it. So what she found was that if she accepted his love, she would violate the internal injunction built into her mind in this transaction with her mother when she was very young. So receiving a love was more dangerous for her than living without love but complaining about it. So I looked at that and then realized that I had been in this therapeutic situation with hundreds of couples that didn't quite understand that the difficulty they had when they began to make progress. We had interpreted as start moving out of a stasis into some new flow of energy that produces normal anxiety. And it does, but in this particular case, when it's intransigent, it's rooted usually in some unconscious catastrophic outcome. If you let love in, then something terrible will happen, so that receiving love is more dangerous than giving love, or more dangerous than doing without love. And that was one of the things we discovered in that process. It also has to do with generally with compliments. that many people, as you know, you do something and they say, hey, that was a good speech. That's a great looking tie. I love your dress. And they say, oh, it's just an old rag. Or I really wasn't on today. I didn't think the speech was very good. So we did hundreds of people and asked them to talk about what the experience was of the rejection of the compliment. And all of them, basically, in terms of a pattern, said the same thing, that with two or three different variations, that if I let in the compliment, that I did well, one person, and this was a whole stream, I will then, that will establish expectations that I always function at a high level, and therefore, blah, 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 it's just too taxing. Another was that people are always insincere, so that I can't believe it. But most of them were that if I let love in, it will require me to release the architecture of my self-concept in which I am a person who has been negatively valued by me and by others, and to let that stasis be uncovered and impacted by this would produce more anxiety than living with the equilibrium that I have. So we have to, again, it's a kind of, how do you get people out of that? So one is to understand where the defense comes from and the catastrophic outcome that could come if you allow yourself to move beyond that defense. And the second is that I found that this reality thing is to collect data over and over again in small amounts until the data has been collected to the point you can't deny it anymore. And at some point, we found that people allow themselves to release that defense and its function in protecting them from a catastrophe that's greater than if they let love in.
Now, it's interesting because part of what I hear you saying is that if we really let in compliments, if we really let in the love of other people, that it will change our self-configuration in some way, that many of us configured ourselves around some smaller person, and we would have to open up to being a bigger, different person, and that's anxiety producing. Is that correct? Is that part of what you're saying?
Exactly. It opens you up, and that new opening up creates an unpredictable possibility. When I'm into my configuration, self-configuration that served me for so long, I can pretty much predict what the next step is going to be. And one of the things the neurosciences are saying is that's one of the things the brain really likes, is to know what's coming next. Otherwise, you're going to anxiety. But if you allow the configuration of protective self-defense to relax, then predictability becomes more problematic, and therefore anxiety becomes more likely.
And so would you say that someone who is able to really let in love in a very, very full way, moment to moment, is someone who's willing to live in a kind of mystery about who they are? They have to become comfortable with this unpredictability?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what happens when you release the architecture of the self that you have lived in and carried around for so long, which is a concept. It's not you. It's a concept. And that when you release that, you then go into not knowing. You go into not knowing who I am, and that's anxiety provoking in itself, because now you have no predictability even about who you are, much less how people will respond to you. So moving into the mystery of not knowing, I think, is essential to the experience of coming to know who we really are, who I think are magnificent creatures connected to an amazing tapestry of being, in which when we're aware of that and have a felt sense of connection, we live in joy. And when we're not living in joy, I'm pretty convinced that when we're not living in joy, it's because something has triggered our anxiety. And so then we go into defense and we experience in ourselves as separate. And if you're separate, then you have to be self-protective. Whereas when you experience yourself being one with, belonging to, being a part of, I think that the accurate description of who we are is connection, not connected, but connection itself. We are connection, and when we're not feeling that, it's because something has ruptured the felt sense of connection, and then we go into insulating ourselves with some sort of defense.
Now, Harville, as a final question, what I'd love to know is, on the spot, what do you do when something comes up and you can see that you might be moving towards something like self-judgment or self-criticism? You know, we started our conversation and I said, do you think zero negativity is possible in relationship to oneself? And what do you do when you start seeing that critical thought arising on the horizon of your awareness?
Well, I do the same thing with myself that I do in relationship. Helen and I, who is a co-creator of Imago, and we've been in this conversation for 35 years, and without Helen, Imago wouldn't exist. And one of the things that we have evolved in dealing with negativity in our relationship and in ourselves is the concept of curiosity. We started off in our own relationship trying to get negativity out of it we started off with going cold turkey. Just one day, since negativity, zero negativity is the ultimate outcome of a good therapy, and it is also essential in a great relationship, we decided we would, since we finally got to that, instead of spending 2 or 3 years, you know, trying to erase it line by line, we would just dump it. We went into a period of, you know, several weeks in which we weren't clear what we could say to each other because our language had become sort of eroded with negativity. And so being both wanting a better relationship and being theoreticians, clinicians, and researchers, we also said, let's figure out what we can do in order to be together. And so one of the first things, and the thing that was out in the community was, you know, the power of positive thinking, positive psychology had shown up. John Gottman had said, you have to give yourself 3 to 5 positives for every negative, or give your partner 3 to 5 for every negative toward them. So we tried positive thinking. We tried positive self-affirmation, positive affirmation of the other. We found it didn't really work for us. Through that process, we began to get into curiosity. Well, what do you think would help? What do you think would help? But what we found was that my curiosity about Helen's thinking about what wasn't working became a more prophylactic for her, more safety creating for her than positive input. So we began to process that. And I found the same thing as Helen would ask me and explore with me what I was thinking, then what after that would happen, and after that, what do you feel? We found that mutual shared interest, as long as we didn't go into judgment and say, well, that's a stupid idea, but as long as we stayed curious and receptive and appreciative, that our anxiety levels went down. So what we now teach couples is that instead of reacting to negativity with negativity or trying to correct it and heal it with positive input, become curious and ask about what's going on when your partner's doing something that that triggers something in you. You have a little flinch or an ouch or whatever. So what works in that relationship also works with me is that if I find myself feeling anxious, what I am aware is that I have experienced in some context a put down. And so what I do is become curious about that and what that put down, what meaning it has, what that behavior meaning has, what the outcome might be. As I go into that curiosity, I find that that regulates my anxiety and I begin to feel better about myself. So neurophysiologically, what happens is that I move again out of the limbic brain, which is always recycles and has the brain's default, according to the neuroscientist Dan Siegel, who's one of my buddies, says the brain's default is always negative because the brain was shaped over, you know, all the millions of years to not assume that if you heard a snap in the forest, that it was somebody coming to play with you or to have sex with you. You had to assume that it was somebody coming to eat you. So that the default, as the negative default of the brain, is self-protective. So you're always going to go there. But then once you've gone there, Helen has a phrase that I really love. You can't control your first thought, but you can certainly control your second thought. And one of the best ways to control it is to get some data. That is the curiosity factor. Get some reality, and then that begins to mitigate the fantasy.
I've been speaking with Dr. Harville Hendricks, and with Sounds True, Harville has created a series called Finding and Keeping Love, an Imago-based program for getting the love you want, and also a program called Marriage as a Path to Wholeness. And he has a forthcoming book, Making Marriage Simple, 10 Simple Truths to a Happy Marriage. I'm definitely looking forward to reading that, Harville. Thank you so much for being part of the Self-Acceptance Project.
You're so welcome, and I'm honored to be. Thank you for checking in.
SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. Thanks for listening.